When did you get into town?
Last night.
Where do you stay?
Where am I staying?
Where do you stay when you're in town?
Well, they're putting me up at a place called the Omni here, which is quite close to here. So we should have been here on time.
Well, that's the one with the big atrium, isn't it?
No, it's on 52nd. It seemed to be a little chain.
Berkshire.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a lovely little hotel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you used to live in New York, didn't you?
Yes, years ago I did. I lived here for 7 years. And then I went out to California and didn't come back.
Mm-hmm. What years were you living in New York?
Late 50s, early 60s.
That was probably a quieter time, wasn't it?
It was. It was a different city. Actually, young people could afford to live here then, I think.
Yeah, I have a next-door neighbor who has lived in New York since the early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, while New York is impressive now in terms of its skyscrapers and so forth, and it doesn't have the L's running through Manhattan, in many ways it was a cleaner, safer, saner place to live. And with a lively population, it just seemed better to him than it does now.
Well, people always say that about the place they've lived in when they were young and they come back to when they're older or stay in when they're older. I just think it was great for me because I came here as an immigrant and I was enchanted with the freedom of it and the excitement of it. But I think when I came back afterwards, I think what happens here is people come in and the generation of people live here and then your friends have moved on somewhere else or moved out to the suburbs. And so the only people you know here are agents and lawyers and people like that.
Besides, I think we kind of have a way of trimming the fat from the past and focusing on the things that are the most outstanding, either traumatically or pleasantly.
That's true. I think that's true.
We look at our childhood, and I can think of the most terrible things that might have happened to me and also the most luscious things. And all the things in between are kind of weeded out.
Boring days are gone, thank God.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you, because you were born in Northern Ireland, weren't you?
Yes, and brought up there.
Tell me, what was it like as you were a child in Northern Ireland then?
Well, it was bad then. It was the days of the Great Depression, and everybody was unemployed, not just the Catholics. And there was a very, 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 very deep division between Catholic and Protestant families. My father was a doctor. We were a middle-class family, and yet we didn't know any Protestants. My father wouldn't, for instance, buy bread from a Protestant baker. He would buy inferior bread from a Catholic baker. But after the war, I thought that things would get a lot better because horizons had broadened, people had been away. And in fact, they might have got better, but we had civil rights marches in Northern Ireland, actually based on the American marches. And at that time, television showed that the police were beating up Catholics and that there were disturbances of these civil rights marches. And unfortunately, at that time, instead of having a happy outcome as it had here, or relatively happy outcome as it had here, it had a bad outcome because the terrorist groups, paramilitary people, moved in and became in the role of protectors of both populations, Protestant and Catholic, and they took over center stage, which meant that the moderate people were sort of pushed aside, and that situation has gone on now for about 20 years.
Were you aware of the troubles as a child?
Oh, yes, you were very aware of we had martial law in Belfast quite often. We used to have riots, supposedly religious riots, which often became food riots, you know, as they do in areas where people are unemployed. So I was quite aware of them, yes. But when I came back after the war, I felt that that the IRA were completely dead and that, you know, it was something from the past. Unfortunately, that hasn't been proven to be true.
Your father, you said your father was adopted, so I guess you had an intellectual upbringing to a degree.
Yes, my people were professional people. My grandfather was a lawyer. My brothers are both doctors. So I don't know if you'd call that more of a professional than an intellectual upbringing.
Now, well, my father, I used to say I grew up with the great books. My father was a businessman, but mm-hmm. as I look back, his books were the complete collection of the Reader's Digest condensed books, which I guess is better than not having any books at all.
But, absolutely.
Have you ever read any of the condensed books?
No, I didn't, but I remember staying in a house here, and I rented a house in Amagansett when I first came here, which was filled with them, and I remember that a young writer then called Philip Roth and his wife came to see me, and his wife said, well, this fellows know yet. Well, what are you wasting time with him for? All he reads is Reader's Digest condensed books. And Philip said to her, don't you realize his house is rented?
Well, you know, they edit stringently these Reader's Digest condensed books. They take out all of the good stuff. You know, all of the explicit material, all of the common language that often makes the book ring true. They edit it out, and also they're very selective. For I was talking to the editor of Reader's Digest Condensed Books once, and he said, we would never publish a book like Sophie's Choice by William Styron. I mean, it's a suicide pact at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So you began to wonder a little bit about it.
Yes, well, I would never have been a Reader's Digest Condensed Choice because most of my books don't end happily.
Well, how did it happen that you left your native Northern Ireland?
Well, I went overseas in the war. I went to work with the British government. I went to North Africa and Italy. And then after the war, I worked with the United Nations in Poland. And so I...
Now, excuse me, what did you do in the war exactly?
I was a port assistant port officer in Naples and then later on in Marseille. We were actually uniformed civil servants. We... Our opposite number in America was called the War Shipping Administration. We looked after merchant ships in combat areas, sailors, giving them supplies and so on. It was, you know, people forget that in wars, a great mass of people are background people.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people are up front.
Did you go back to Northern Ireland after that?
No, I went to Poland and lived there for 2 years and, doing much the same job, at the time when the UN was bringing supplies into Eastern European countries.
And then what happened?
Then I fell in love with a girl and went to Canada and followed her out there. She was a Canadian and she told me to get lost. And I was stranded there and I...
Stranded in Canada?
In Canada, yes. And I wanted to decide I would try and become a newspaper man. And actually the only job I could get was as a proofreader first, and then I did become a newspaper man, quite successful at it, and did a lot of features. But by the time I was 27, I decided that I didn't want to have a city editor telling me what to do when I was 40 every morning, so I'd always thought that I would like to be a real writer. And I assembled a few pennies and sat down and wrote my first book.
What paper did you work for?
The Montreal Gazette.
I kind of admire the phrase, I wanted to be a real writer. I was a journalism major, mm-hmm. and I write here at mm-hmm. CBS. But I don't consider it real writing either. I mean, it's so formulaic. There's a way that you must write that conforms to what is expected of you that you cannot conceivably do in creative writing. And yet, there are many people, well, you have a newspaper background, mm-hmm. and there are many people who have made that. Hemingway is another one. They made that jump.
I thought it was a great training, actually. I came there as an immigrant, and I was taught who, what, why, when, and where. I was taught that you have to sit down and do it, and not delay. And I was also, you'd write some wonderful story and bring it up to a desk where some elderly person would take three paragraphs out instantly. And so I think it's very good training. I think it's bad training if people stay in it too long, because, as you say, it becomes formulaic after a while. But I don't see that Hemingway is a perfect example. That Hemingway's training as a journalist on the Toronto Star was actually, I think, formed his style.
Yeah, it does. In some respects, it's helpful in that it makes you think with a certain degree of clarity. Although
some
of the copy I've seen around here, I wouldn't pass my test. Well, your first novel, which was set in Belfast. It's still in print, I understand.
That's right.
For all these years. Tell me about how that came to be.
Well, it was called The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn, and I was, as I said, I was young at the time, and I decided I would try and write a story about someone losing their religious faith. And I didn't want to compete with James Joyce, so I decided to write about someone my mother might have known, an elderly lady, a lady who was a spinster, who was waiting for Mr. Wright, and I sat down quite foolhardily, wrote it all from her point of view, and the book was, well, never a bestseller. I had great trouble getting it published. It was published in England immediately, but only because they thought I had another book in me. It was rejected by 12 American publishers, too depressing. And then when it got good reviews in England, it was all those publishers came back and said that they had never seen it before and liked to read it, and I was able to tell them that they had seen it. It was published here, got very good reviews, and it's never been out of print since 1955, which is sort of astonishing.
This theme about the loss of religious faith why is this of interest or concern to you?
Well, I've always been interested as a novelist in people losing their beliefs. Maybe you believe in religion, maybe you believe in politics, maybe you believe that you have a great talent, or you believe in love, but all of us at some point in our lives face a moment of crisis in which that belief is challenged. And it's that period that interests me in people's life, that moment of crisis when whatever it is we hoped would happen is not going to happen. And so I put my characters through those moments of crisis. Let's say it takes a month, 3 months, or 3 weeks. But sometimes they don't solve the crisis. Sometimes they accept the failure. Most often they do. And that's why I never know how the book's going to end. I go through the crisis with them and then hope that they will know something more about themselves, and so will I by the time we finish.
We're leading up to Lies of Silence, by the way. I'm just trying to do this in kind of a chronological order. What happened to you after the publication of this novel?
Well, I became a professional writer, and therefore divorced from real life.
That's not an easy thing to do, though, is it, to be a full-time creative writer?
Well, I did some journalism for a while. Well, I continued, but I was lucky in that my books were published in England, and they were published in some European countries. And while I was never a bestseller, from quite early age, my books have had an international audience of sorts, which has enabled me to live and do write the sort of books I want to write. So in that sense, I've been a very lucky writer. I didn't have one great success which had to be followed by a failure. My books sort of accumulated a readership, and I think I'm very fortunate in that.
You never actually had a formal education, did you?
Oh, yes.
In terms of writing?
Oh, no, not does anyone?
Well, if you look at the United States, there are creative writing divisions in almost every college now.
Yes, and I've taught one myself at UCLA.
You're still teaching that, aren't you?
Well, I only teach it one quarter because I like to keep freedom. I don't want to have tenure and become a professor. But I don't think you teach people to write, but you can teach people to rewrite their own writing. And that's I think that's what those courses sometimes do. In addition to which, I think young people who want to be writers are it may not seem that way to you, but they are a minority in this country. And the fact of being with other, I only teach undergraduates. I don't want to teach graduates or already academics. But I think that young people who want to write, it's good for them to meet other people of their age who want to do the same thing. So the community of meeting together and discussing their work, I think, does help them.
Yeah, it would seem to me that a writer lives in, to a degree, a vacuum, because it's such a solitary profession that to be able to break out of this vacuum and communicate and explore the nature of his work with other people who have read it would be extremely helpful.
Yeah, I also think that's why a number of people write two novels and then go on to do something else, because the loneliness of a novelist's life is something that most people find unhealthy and don't want to go on with. I was lucky in the sense that it suited me for some reason. Perhaps because I had done journalism, I was accustomed to working alone, and it never was a problem for me. But I think that if you see someone who's written 10 or 12 novels, then they have lived a very unnatural life because they've been alone most of the time.
And yet, here you and I are talking about your work now. I think that some people don't like to do it in a public forum like this, but at the same time, don't you think it's helpful even for a veteran writer such as yourself to be able to sit here and talk about the things you've done and how words appear magically, strangely on paper?
It depends on the interviewer. I don't know. It really does depend on the interviewer. Some people, I think good interviews with people who have written books are people who are able to make it, as I hope you're doing now, a conversation. But to answer a list of questions can be very difficult. It's like being on trial.
Well, let's talk a little bit about The Lies of Silence. This was a wonderful book, and it's actually a book that appears in two parts, the 48 hours or so set in Belfast. I kind of lost track of the time, and then the second period, which takes place in London. And tell me how this book developed in your mind.
Well, I'm an expatriate from Ireland. I go back a lot, and I have family there, brothers and sisters. And I never intended to write another book about Ireland, certainly not a book about the Northern Ireland Troubles, because I think for today, for a novelist to write about something journalistically, events are going to catch up with you and make you out of date. But I was in Belfast, and I was in a hotel, and we were put out in the middle of the night by a bomb scare, which is common there. And it was a hotel near the university, and the students had been, it was graduation week, and the students were all wandering around drunk and having a good time, even though they'd been put out of the hotel. But there were a group of middle-aged French tourists nearby, and I speak French, and I was listening to them and realized that they had absolutely no idea what had happened and what was wrong. They thought it was a fire. I thought, what if they were all bombed, killed tonight? What if any of us were in a situation like this where we were in the wrong place at the wrong time and killed for no reason, just because we happened to be there? And then I began to think of the fact that the IRA and, of course, the Protestant paramilitaries too do take hostages all the time. They go into people's houses at night and they borrow their car and they sit with them all night until they return the car after doing some terrorist act, or they go into a house to watch another place and hold the family hostage. And I realized that these people never speak. They never seem to say anything to the police. Nobody, you know, everybody's afraid to talk. So those two things I put together, and I thought, what if I were the manager of this hotel and I'd been used by the IRA to plant the bomb in the hotel? And that was what gave me the idea for doing it. And then I realized that if I thought of it that way, then the way to write it would be, unliterary though it seems, it would be to write it as a thriller.
Now, the protagonist in the book is Michael Dillon, the hotel manager, and I was very surprised to discover that Michael Dillon and his wife are Catholics, and yet here the IRA break into their home, terrorize them, and force Michael to go back to the hotel with a bomb in the car. Now, isn't this unusual for the IRA to strike at fellow Catholics?
Oh, not at all. In fact, most of the people they use as hostages are quite often Catholics, because, first of all, they think they'll be intimidated and won't want to inform against them, so that's perfectly common. The fact that they're like all terrorist groups, if the hotel manager had been a Protestant, they would have done it too, but he happened to be a Catholic, so he suited their purpose.
But doesn't that work against the IRA?
Yes, it does, and it's people here don't realize that most people in Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland are sick of the IRA. We've had 20 years of terrorism. They tend to do a lot of bungling. They tend to kill a lot of people. They set out to kill one bunch of people, and they often kill their own people. And that they really have no parish left in Ireland. That's hard for people to believe, but it's true. Not a month ago, they set out to kill a bunch of off-duty policemen. I don't know if you noticed the story. It was in the newspapers. They blew up a car, but it happened to be the wrong car. There were three nuns in it. Well, this doesn't make them popular among Catholics in Ireland.
Yeah, but don't you put yourself at risk to a certain degree by criticizing the IRA? As you point out yourself in Lines of Silence, it seems to have a very long reach.
It does, but then a lot of people, politicians, ordinary people in Ireland have criticized the IRA publicly, but these criticisms mostly appear only in Irish newspapers. So I don't think that I'm particularly at risk, and if I were particularly at risk, it wouldn't stop me writing a book, I don't think.
One of the most unsavory characters in the book is the Catholic priest who approaches Michael, trying to encourage him not to go to the police or tell the police about exactly what happened inside that house, because Michael did see through the mirror, the reflection of one of the young terrorists. Tell me about this character and how he evolved.
Well, there are a number of Catholic priests and Catholic bishops in Northern Ireland who are totally against the IRA, but there has been an ambivalence among others about the attitude towards the IRA. The late Cardinal Fee used to make statements which most of us felt were very dubious. He would say, I'm from South Armagh, so I know how these people feel. And he talked about them as the lads. And so this was very, very totally un-Catholic. First of all, the Catholic Church is totally against terrorism and should be. This ambivalent attitude from the top down affects some priests in Northern Ireland who appear at IRA funerals and make sort of nationalistic statements. On the other hand, you have bishops like Bishop Daly of Derry, who's a very powerful Catholic bishop there, is totally against them and speaks out against them. I wanted to point out that some Catholic priests, kind of boys I went to school with when I was young, have very mixed feelings about all this, and they're taking a political role which they have no right to take, which is contrary to the Catholic teaching and contrary to the Church's stated position in Northern Ireland.
I can't. One thing that puzzled me a little bit is why Michael Dillon allowed this priest to ingratiate himself with Michael. If knowing Michael's vulnerability, I would have not answered my phone, not left a forwarding address.
Well, he thought it was mixed up with his wife. He thought actually it had something to do with his wife, which is why he let him into the house in the first place. And I did try to point out something at the end, which I think a lot of people might have missed, is that the priest actually is the uncle of one of these terrorists, and he's acting as a relative. And when he informs the IRA that Dillon knows more than he should, he then comes to London to try to stop him, to try to get him to pull back. He comes in a sense to London to save his life. But the trouble with sectarian hatred is the Catholics consider the Protestants devils, the Protestants consider the Catholics devils, and at the end of the book, Michael Dillon is so hates this priest, and he's so anti-priest, that he doesn't listen to the man's warning. And by walking away from him, he perpetrates to me the sectarian problem, which is that if you think the other person, if you think the guy walked in here is a Nazi, you're not going to listen to anything he says if you're anti-Nazi. And so that's what happens in this situation.
This book was written with such skill and with such suspense that I read this book in one sitting, which meant maybe 4, maybe 5 hours of reading. And yet you probably spent a year or 2 years on the book. Isn't this kind of frustrating to a writer to spend all of the time writing this book and somebody reads it just like that?
Oh, I think just the opposite. I'm very, very happy when people say to me, I read your book in a sitting or I read it in two sittings. Because first of all, it means they were interested. I mean, perhaps in your case it was duty, but most people it's because they're interested. And secondly, because I think today, you know, we're looking at film, we're looking at television, we're looking at world events all the time. And if I read a book over a period of a month, I may have lost the thread of the book. I think that the fact that you've held someone's attention for that amount of time is something to celebrate, not something to worry about.
Well, the book is still vivid in my mind. I read it probably 3 weeks ago, but I still think about it, and its echoes I carry with me. You mentioned something a moment ago about not exactly being sure where you're going in terms of writing the book. I've misinterpreted mm-hmm. what you said, but tell me how you approach the writing of a novel.
Well, yes, that's very relevant in my books. I try to find, as I said, the point in someone's life where they're in a moment of crisis, where whatever it is they believed in, or whoever it is they thought they were, perhaps they're not. And so I don't know, I start the books with a character and a situation, and I don't know how I'm going to end the book or what's going to happen to it. I didn't know the ending of this book until I was very close to it. It could have gone either way. I don't want to give the ending, but it could have gone either way, and suddenly it seemed inevitable that it would go this way. And I found, my own experience of writing novels is I found that when I don't know quite often what's going to happen in a novel, I don't know when it's going to end, there seems to be some moment at which it seems to solve itself, perhaps in my subconscious, and at that moment I go on and the book is over.
Well, I was talking to two different writers who have two different approaches. Maybe you could comment on this. One writer, Bobby Ann Mason, was telling me that sometimes she has just a theme, just an idea of, say, a swarm of bumblebees entering an attic. And she wants to write something about it. And it starts with that, and then a character will evolve. And it's not clear-cut as to how she approaches it. I've talked to other writers who say, I'm not going to start a book until I know exactly where I'm going. It's outlined, and there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, period. Now, this is the mysterious creative process, and I don't know that there's any one way to do it, but perhaps you have some thoughts about that.
Well, I suppose everybody has their own method of working, so I'm not going to antagonize anybody by saying this. But for me, the writer who has set the whole book up, knows the ending, has got it all worked out, is going to be then the prisoner of the iron straitjacket he put himself into. Because to me, writing is writing novels anyway, is a process of finding out about the character. If you meet somebody at a party, you say, well, you make a judgment on them right away. But if you know them over several months, you then begin to know more about them, and they become more complex. So I'm very much very dubious of people who've... it's like people who say, I'm writing a trilogy. I always think, how can you be writing a trilogy? But the example I think is relevant is Tolstoy. Tolstoy read about Anna Karenina as a woman, you know, committed suicide and because of a love affair. And he was very contemptuous of her because he was an aristocrat and she was someone who betrayed her class. And he began to write about her with great contempt. And as he wrote about her, as he said in his own notes, he didn't put it this clearly, but what happened was he fell in love with the character. And he began to fall in love with Anna and think a lot about Anna. And that's what made it a great book. He who was a very macho sort of person, developed this great sympathy with a female character. And that's what makes it a wonderful novel. But the wonderful thing was that 15 years later, he was asked about it, and he said, oh, I hated that book. It was a book about a woman who had an adultery. She was a pathetic character. So he'd fallen out of love with her once he'd finished the book. So I think if you, what I'm saying is, if you set the plot and you know the answers, you're not giving yourself a chance to fall in love with the character.
I think in some of the publicity material Doubleday sent over, you were quoted as saying that you dislike historical novels, and yet one of your most popular novels was set in the 17th century, a historical novel.
Yes, well, I think I've always hated historical novels because they were so long, and the writers had done so much research they put it in. So when I did this historical novel, I said, well, this is going to be a short historical novel with no loads of research in it. And I thought I'm going to tell it as a tale, a Conradian tale. And when I plunged into it, I really enjoyed it because it was putting myself in another world and another time. And actually, they're making a film of it right now in Canada with Bruce Beresford as directing it. And I wrote the script for it, so I had another chance to even shorten the novel.
How does writing a movie script compare to doing the actual work of a novel?
It's a totally collaborative effort, and it's a great gamble for the writer. I enjoyed working on this one, and I've enjoyed working on a couple of other ones of mine, but it very much depends on the director and on his sensibility and how you get on. And you've got to realize that there's a certain depth that's lost, and one hopes a certain narrative that's gained.
Now, I've heard a lot about film writing, and particularly movies based on books and how everything has changed. And you mentioned collaborative effort. It's really out of the hands of the writer once the director has it and visualizes what he needs to do. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a matter of practicality. There's certain
Absolutely.
Things you just can't do. And, mm-hmm. So there are shortcuts. I'm amazed at how well some movies do come across based on the literary books, and it's a hard thing to do.
Well, it's just a different form, and for people who've never read the book, it can be very satisfying. And in some cases, it can lead them back to reading your book. I found they did a little film in one of my books called Catholics some years ago with Trevor Howard and Martin Sheen, and I wrote the script for that too, and I realized that I had to change it because everything takes place inside this abbot's head, and that couldn't happen in a film. So we had to have a confidant, in other words, tell these things to somebody, which was against his character. And I was a little bit worried about that. But then at the end of it, I think it stood up on its own, and it had something that, you know, you cannot ignore. The night it was done, actually it was done by CBS, the night it was done as a film, people called me from Ireland, from England, from all over the States, and I suddenly said, well, even if it wasn't as good as the book, 7.5 times the population of Ireland saw this tonight.
Let's give you a lot of satisfaction, though, to see your work transformed into film and exposed to even a wider audience.
I don't really know that it does. It's fascinating because it's not your book anymore. It's a film you're seeing. And you judge it as a film. You judge it as something else, because the writing isn't your writing, for one thing. I mean, the dialogue may be, but the writing isn't there. It's the director's writing.
Yeah, I was talking to novelist Sue Miller, who wrote The Good Mother, and which was filmed with Diane Keaton, I believe, mm-hmm. in the major role. And Sue told me that She has yet to see that film. She can't. She can't go. Because to her, I don't know if she was exaggerating, but she said to me that she felt that she wanted to hold that book in her imagination and the characters in her imagination and didn't want to see what somebody else had done with her people.
Well, she's right in one thing. Ever since I saw Catholics, I see the abbot as Trevor Howard. There's no other way.
There you are.
He is. He's the abbot.
Case in point. Well, I know if I wrote a book that became a movie, I couldn't wait to see have to see what they had done with it. You know, if it's bad, you
that's
know,
true. I mean, she's probably a purer soul than we are.
I'm reading a historical novel now by Tom Tryon, which I just hate. I'm going to interview Tom on Friday, and I've interviewed him before, and I've liked some of his work. But this book is a multi-generational book, and you mentioned trilogy. I think he said there are going to be two more. It's about 1,000 pages, and he's writing the longest sentences I ever read. If he could take one sentence and break it into three, it would make it much easier on me. Mm-hmm. I get lost in the middle there.
Yes.
And also some of the, I don't mean to bitch about his writing, but some of the, it seems as though he's written a historical Gothic, like these paperback books, and where the phrases are, he scowled darkly. I mean, I don't know if there's any other way to scowl.
Can you scowl lightly?
So I'm just, and what's happening to me, and this didn't happen to me with Lies of Silence, and it wasn't a duty that I, you know, I enjoyed this. I can pick and choose often the books that I review and the interviews I do. And so this was not something I had to do. But with Tom Tryon's book, I feel as though I have narcolepsy. Because every so often I just seem to drift off, you know, and I try to prop my head back up. And I'm only that way through. I've got till Friday to finish it. So what an ordeal.
Well, you're saying in another way what you asked me. I was pleased when you said you'd read my book quickly. It's the same thing, really, because very, very long novels became a sort of elephantized the novel, I think, became, it was a 19th century thing to begin with, Dickens and all these people with very long novels. But when I first came to America, the thing I noticed is that people like Saul Bellow, who had started writing short novels, the novels became bigger, because I think there's a thing that used to be true, I think, in America, where the great American novel could never be seen as a very short novel. It should have to be a big novel.
Well, I think it's more than that. Mm-hmm. I think that often a writer, as he becomes more skilled, wants to outdo himself, top himself.
And to write more by that?
Well, I don't know. I've noticed this myself. I noticed James Dickey's last novel, a book called Alalam, hard to pronounce, terrible title. It was that thick. Mm-hmm. And also he had split the screen, so to speak, so he had dialogue in one half of the page and competing dialogue in the other half of the page. Very difficult to follow. And the book really bombed. It was a shame. But his first novel, which was called Deliverance, is a little tiny book.
Mm-hmm. And that's the one people remember.
It was a wonderful book. And I just wonder why Dickey felt that he had to write this huge tome. And it didn't really work too well. I read it, and I interviewed him on the occasion of that book. But I wasn't very happy with the book. But then he's not writing for me.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm not these other writers, but what's happened to me over the years is I seem to have written usually in one length, but as I get older and have written more books, I become even sparer than I was. In other words, I suppose I see the mistakes that I once made by overwriting, and they come back to haunt you if you ever see a sentence that you've overwritten. It's still, I never go back and look at my books, but sometimes by accident I do see something like that. And I'm afraid of that. So I think what happens to an equal number of writers is as they get older, they become more spare in their writing. Don't you think that's possible?
More spare? No, I think it's the other way around for most writers. I think they still have to seek to write a masterpiece. And the bigger the book it is, the more the masterpiece is going to be. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at some of the real masterpieces in the world, Orwell stuff, 1984, or Animal Farm. Look at the tiny books. Catcher in the Rye.
That's true. I've always thought that. I've always thought that even with great writers that, for instance, Dostoevsky never wrote anything better than Notes from Underground for me. And Tolstoy's short novels are wonderful, the Kreutzer Sonata. Chekhov didn't write long. Flaubert, his worst books were the books Beauvoir and Pécuchet, the books which he spread himself, Salammbô. Madame Bovary is not a long novel, which is the novel that he's most remembered by. So I think there's a lesson in that. Everything has its own length, and you cannot tamper with that length. When I wrote Catholics, for instance, it was only 117 pages long, and I had some difficulty having it published because people felt it was a novella that was too short to be commercially publishable, and my publishers in America, when they published it, wanted to publish it with some short stories, and I said no, because I said one will detract from the other. But it was published, and also I think another thing to mention is that, you know, short books can be bought by the book clubs.
They cannot be?
No, because the book club needs a book to be of a certain length so that they can cut it down and sell it more cheaply to the readers, which is what book clubs are all about. And if they've got a short book, they have to try and make it a jewel selection or something, which is difficult for them.
Well, there's another thing to comment on too, the popularity of the murder mysteries. And some of them are extremely well done, and they're all short, and yet people love them. They love mm-hmm. this genre, and also murder mysteries appeal to a wide intellectual audience, mm-hmm. and they love it. These books aren't long. Mm-hmm. It just seems it's so intimidating to see a great big book. I was talking to James Clavell. This last book he wrote called Whirlwind was that thick. And it was, I think at the time he sold that book, he got $5 million, or something. It was a record amount. And so I interviewed him on the occasion in this book, and he said, well, look what you have here. He said, you've got four books in one. He said, instead of going out and buying four books, all you have to do is buy one book. But after you started reading it, you know, all the characters, like, you got lost, and all the characters were the same. And I think William Morrow, I think, published it. I guess they made money mm-hmm. on the book, but... And it was a popular book, so, I mean, there is something to be said about blockbusters.
Well, I think the other thing about American blockbusters is that Michener's books, for instance, convey information palatably to the audience, and the audience often says, well, I'm being educated by this book.
That's interesting you said that, because just last week I had on the air Jay Perini. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but his last book, his last novel was called The Last Station, which was about the last year of Tolstoy's life. It's a small book. It's about mm-hmm. 200 pages. It's a historical novel. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about historical novels, and he was saying he hated these books that Michener mm-hmm. writes because he drops so many facts in, like congealed bits of fat.
Mm-hmm.
But Jay wrote a novel that really tells you, gives you the feeling of I think the year was 1910.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And you really got the feeling of that year, and you got the feeling what Tolstoy was like. But he didn't have to go into the process of describing how a manor house was run.
Or also Tolstoy's earlier life, I imagine, if he just did The Last Station.
Well, it hinted at the mm-hmm. earlier life. Mm-hmm. So you did have a feeling about what Tolstoy's entire life was about without giving all the detail.
Then that's a wonderful subject for a novel, because Tolstoy's death was very dramatic and was the first media death of any author.
Have you read that novel?
No, but I know his death very well. I mean, I've read Triad. I know exactly what happened.
Yeah, he goes into great detail about this carnival at the end of the life. And it's a wonder if you have a chance to pick it up.
I must read it, because I've always been interested in that period.
Well, Brian Moore, we could go on talking, but we're out of time. I know you have other things to do, and so do I. This was a wonderful book, Lies of Silence. I was the ending. I'm not going to give that away on the air. I was shocked by the ending. I was hoping for something else. But in life, sometimes that doesn't happen, and Lies of Silence is not a great B-movie of the 1940s where everything had to end up. It's a beautiful book. Thank you very, very much. Nice talking to you.
Thank you for having me.